Welcome to Session 8 of Mind in the Cosmos. The title of this lecture is Consciousness, Truth or Wisdom? In exploring consciousness, are we searching for truth or for wisdom? In this session, I will introduce a personal narrative about how I came to realize the limitations of mainstream academic philosophy and how I opened to a different kind of philosophy, one more aligned with its original intent and meaning, that is, the love of wisdom. I will tell the story of my own awakening and how I came to understand two different kinds of consciousness, between reason-based consciousness and feeling-based consciousness, between dialectic and dialogue. I will conclude this session by looking at how we may integrate these very different modes of consciousness and how we may use them to integrate different worldviews on mind and body, on consciousness and cosmos. So, in exploring consciousness, are we searching for truth or for wisdom? In other words, are we interested in gaining good conceptual understanding of consciousness, or are we more interested in the transformative potentials of consciousness? Another way of looking at this is to ask, are we interested in finding out decisive facts about consciousness, or are we interested in enlightening experience? In other words, do we want additional theoretical knowledge, or do we want deeper insights into how we might live our lives? These are two very different options and motivations for the exploration of consciousness. Now, another way to ask all of this is, are we looking for consciousness through words or through silence? These two major options are open to us when we inquire into the nature of consciousness, and which one we choose will depend on our motivation. Do we want to study consciousness because we want to understand it, to be able to talk or write or think about it coherently? Or are we drawn to the study of consciousness because we want to know it from within, in a way that illuminates our lives? The first approach gives us philosophic truth, and the second can lead to spiritual wisdom. Over the years, as I moved deeper into philosophy and the study of consciousness, I came to realize that all my work focused on three basic questions. The first is, how far back in evolution does consciousness go? The second, are philosophic truth and spiritual wisdom compatible? And then the third is, can we integrate radically different worldviews on mind and body? Today, as a philosopher, I'm interested in rehumanizing or radicalizing philosophy of mind, to move beyond what sometimes seems like an obsession with abstract linguistic logic chopping, and instead open up philosophy to include different ways of knowing. I believe that unless we do so, philosophy will fail to live up to its name, love of wisdom. So let me begin with a personal story. I first became fascinated with consciousness as a 7 or 8 year old kid in Ireland. It was a rainy afternoon, and with nothing else to do, I took down my father's old and tattered encyclopedia from the bookshelf and stopped at an entry on evolution. An old line drawing of a dinosaur had caught my attention at first, but then I lost myself in the text, understanding as much as I could at that age. I probably didn't even know the word consciousness then, but I knew words such as thinking and thought and mind. And on that day I grasped enough to set in place the direction for the rest of my life's work. in reading that entry in evolution, I discovered that not only was I descended from my parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on all the way back to the beginnings of humanity, but that the entire human race evolved from some ape-like ancestors, who came from some even more primitive mammals, who came from reptiles, who came from amphibians, who came from fishes, who came from jellyfishes, who came from clumps of cells, all the way down to single-celled creatures called, in that old encyclopedia, infusoria. Today, we would call them protozoa or bacteria. So I was truly astounded at the revelation that my earliest relatives were bacteria. I sat there on that rainy winter's afternoon, daydreaming out the window, imagining the vast panorama of evolution. From humblest beginnings, life had grown and developed and had produced all this, including me. I spoke the word aloud, enjoying the onomatopoeia. Evolution. It sounded like a great unfolding, a rolling out of hidden forms, now mimicked in the way my tongue uncurled from the roof of my mouth. But something even more astounding grabbed me. Not only was I mesmerized by images of descending species culminating in this young fella sitting there reading a big, dusty old book. Somehow, that stupendous unfolding managed to produce the ability to look back and contemplate the process of evolution itself. Somehow, somewhere along the line, evolution had become aware of itself. As I said, at that time I probably didn't know the word consciousness, but was probably familiar with words like mind or thinking or knowing. And I wondered, how could those ancient infusoria have ever produced mind or thoughts? And just where did mind first appear? I could very easily believe that our dog and our cat had something like a mind. Same with our pet bird. So I went eye to eye with my dog, and after a few moments I was pretty sure that he had it, and checked out my cat, and I was pretty sure that she had it too. And then went eye to eye with my pet goldfish, and after a few moments of hesitation, I was convinced that the goldfish had consciousness as well. But then what about the worms in the back garden? What about the starfish and jellyfish washed up on the sand at the beach? I couldn't decide one way or the other about these creatures. So I came to believe that this remarkable ability we call consciousness came into existence somewhere between worms and fish. But where exactly? Where in the great unfolding of evolution did mind or consciousness first appear? At what stage did evolution produce consciousness? I had no answers. The encyclopedia gave no clues, and my parents and teachers, it seemed, could hardly understand my questions. They spoke to me of souls and God's mysterious ways, and I was left wondering and unsatisfied, because as far as I could make out, they were telling me only humans had souls. But such religious explanations did not fit what I had learned from the encyclopedia, nor what I experienced for myself. No, whatever consciousness or soul was, it was not unique to humans. But how far back did it go? Well, I grew up puzzled, not that such questions burned in my childhood mind every day, but from time to time I would think back on those dinosaurs and infusoria and wonder about evolution, wonder about the feelings and thoughts pulsing through me and other creatures. I wondered, too, why the stories I was learning from science and religion didn't match. As I grew into teenhood, the old questions returned with new force. experiences of unrequited love triggered bouts of existential anguish. What was it all about? Where did we come from? Trying to figure things out didn't help a whittle. Emotions were so powerful they swamped cool reason. Why the conflict? I wondered. In my later teens and early 20s, the cauldron of questions boiled over and I was driven to find answers. But again, no account satisfied the deepest and most troubling questions about the origin of consciousness, about the clash between reason and emotion, and the gap between science and religion. By then, I had lost faith in the traditional priestly stories and had turned to science as the most reliable source of truth. But textbooks on psychology talked only about nervous systems, conditioned reflexes, stimulus and response. Nothing in the words I read came anywhere close to connecting with what I was actually feeling. The disconnect between academic attempts to explain the mind and my youthful, highly charged lived experience was dramatic. Disappointed now with both science and religion, I eventually turned to philosophy. At first, the philosophical writings in mind were even more incomprehensible than the scientific treatises on neurons and brains. So I turned to the teachings of the East, and here in the traditions of Taoism, Buddhism, and Hinduism, I discovered language and imagery and ideas that deeply resonated with my own experiences. I spent many wonderful years steeped in the exploration of these traditions. But beyond telling me that mind or consciousness was the source of all, including matter, in the end I found little in Eastern philosophies to quench a growing and burning desire to know about the relationship between body and mind and how consciousness could have evolved from matter. And this had become the driving question for me. Years later, I returned to the philosophical texts of the West, particularly those focused on the precise questions that troubled me: the nature of mind, the nature of matter, and how one was related to the other. So I went back to college, and through perseverance and determination, I cracked the code of Western philosophical jargon. I began to understand what they were saying about the mind-body problem. I came to appreciate and then love the rigor and precision that philosophers apply to language, to hone and dissect distinctions that lay buried beneath superficial assumptions. I learned to use the surgical skills of logic and analysis to cut through linguistic and conceptual confusions surrounding the great questions. I learned to use and value the philosopher's gift of reason. In debates, discussions, and arguments, I wielded the saber and scalpel to slash away at incautious and sloppy thinking about the nature of consciousness and how it might have emerged from matter. I enjoyed diving into the academic fray, pursuing the no-mercy approach to the search for truth. If others were bemused, cornered, or offended by the sharpness of my philosopher's tongue, that was an acceptable, even necessary, price to pay for truth. I single-mindedly dissected all the competing views on the mind-body problem, slicing through the conceptual knots, befuddling dualism, materialism, and idealism, finding serious flaws in all of them. And then I found my answer. Shortly after my 40th birthday, the eureka arrived like a thunderbolt when I rediscovered the work of Alfred North Whitehead. I discovered that the answer to my lifelong question, where in the great unfolding of evolution did consciousness first appear, was simple. The simple answer was nowhere. Consciousness was always there. No matter how far back along the path of evolution you went, There it was, back beyond the fishes and jellyfishes, back beyond the worms and even the bacteria and infusoria, further still, back beyond the organic chemicals of life, DNA and proteins, back beyond the molecules and their constituent atoms, back to the elementary particles, and back to the quarks or quanta or superstrings or whatever the fundamental constituents of the entire cosmos of matter and energy might be, there had to be some trace of consciousness. Where the worldviews of dualism, materialism, and idealism failed, I now had a rational and coherent story of consciousness and evolution in the worldview called panpsychism. Consciousness, I could now see, must go all the way down. Of all the worldviews attempting to account for the mind-body relation, this was the most controversial and the least academically respectable. Few philosophical books or articles gave even passing notice to the ideas of panpsychism, and those that did mention it tended to dismiss it as unworthy of serious consideration. Throwaway comments such as, "Panpsychism asks us to believe that rocks and trees have thoughts," implied we were being asked to accept that lowly clumps of matter could think like humans. How absurd to believe rocks could spin out sonnets like Shakespeare's or equations like Einstein. But such criticisms completely misrepresented panpsychism and consciousness. The critics rarely, if ever, took the trouble to find out firsthand just what panpsychist philosophers such as Whitehead were actually saying. I did take the trouble, and I found what seemed to me to be the most coherent and sensible philosophical position on the mind-body problem. And because panpsychism was so controversial and misunderstood, I took extra trouble to make sure I could offer a respectable defense against inevitable attacks. The best line of defense, I came to believe, typical of academic philosophy, was to be rigorous and ruthless in attack. So I spent years mastering and dissecting the opposing views of dualism, materialism, and idealism. The bottom line failures of each of these worldviews could be expressed simply. I'll briefly recap here the three major worldviews on the mind-body problem that we've covered in earlier lectures. For dualism, it's the problem of interaction. You may remember, dualism requires a miracle to explain how two utterly different and separate substances could ever interact. Yet plainly, mind and body interact moment by moment in our own experience. Then there's materialism, with the problem of emergence. Materialism likewise requires a miracle to explain how sentient, subjective minds could ever evolve or emerge out of matter that was wholly insentient and objective to begin with. And so we come to idealism. And here the problem is one of realism, because idealism also requires a miracle of one kind or another. Either it requires the unreality of physical reality, or the creation of real matter from pure spirit. Idealism asks us to believe that either all matter is ultimately illusion, that's the Maya hypothesis, or that matter emanates from pure mind or spirit, the emanationist form of idealism. The first option leaves unresolved the pragmatic problem of living in the world if we do not treat matter as real. Matter forces us to acknowledge its reality, despite the claims of idealists. The second option is merely the flip side of materialism. It asks us to believe physical matter could evolve or emerge or emanate from wholly non-physical mind or spirit. And which brings us to the fourth alternative of panpsychism. And this worldview, unlike the other three, doesn't require a miracle or any supernatural intervention. Panpsychism takes the position that both mind and matter are real and natural, and that neither one has ontological priority over the other, that neither mind gives rise to matter, nor does matter give rise to mind. And according to panpsychism, as we saw in an earlier lecture, it is inconceivable that subjectivity and sentience could ever evolve or emerge from wholly objective and insentient matter energy. And likewise, objectivity and physicality could never emerge from wholly non-objective, non-physical mind. Well, having mastered the different philosophies of dualism, materialism, idealism, and panpsychism, I delighted in responding to critics of panpsychism by pointing out flaws in all the other positions. I felt like a warrior for truth, a defender of a philosophical underdog. I crusaded for rational coherence in any attempt to solve the mind-body problem, and, very simply, that meant no miracles. But I wasn't only a philosopher, I was also, first and foremost, a human being. And I knew very well from personal experience that the road to truth was not only via reason. It was perfectly possible that despite the best efforts of reason, the deep nature of reality would elude rational understanding. I knew I had at least three options. One, that reason could penetrate the mind-body mystery, that's the rationalist position. Two, that reason could not comprehend that mystery, the position of people who call themselves mysterians. And three, the third option, is that rationalism alone would be insufficient to solve the mind-body problem, but that supported by other ways of knowing, human consciousness could indeed penetrate the mystery. And that's the noetic position. Well, nevertheless, as a philosopher, I believed I had a duty to honor the gift of reason and pursue it as far as it could take me. Anyone, philosopher or not, attempting to discuss the mind-body problem or the nature of consciousness is automatically in the territory of philosophy, and therefore should be subject to the strictures of reason and logic. Whether or not consciousness and the mind-body problem are mysterious, as soon as we begin thinking or talking about them, we are immediately in the domain of the philosopher, and we should make full use of the precision tools of reason and intellect. Well, by now I had developed an attitude that I could sum up as, if you do not respect the rules of logic and rational coherence, and take the trouble and effort to discover what others have said, then you have no business talking about philosophical topics such as consciousness and the mind-body problem. And if you did, I would show little mercy in pointing out inconsistencies in your reasoning. I would try to convince you of the errors in your thinking and get you to give up your fractured and incoherent beliefs. If I was accused of being unnecessarily harsh in my arguments, I would remind myself and my challengers that what mattered was the search for truth. If along the way we had to let go of cherished beliefs, and if this meant feeling upset, anxious, uncomfortable, or diminished in some way, well, so be it. Such experiences should be welcomed as valuable stages in the learning process. No pain, no gain, I believed, was as true in philosophy as anywhere else. And although this attitude may have found some justification within its own limited context, it often felt flat and one-dimensional. It left something precious, something out that was precious about human relationship. This realization came home to me with full force a few years ago at one of the early Tucson conferences on consciousness hosted by the University of Arizona. At one of the sessions, a young materialist philosopher enthusiastically presented his own defense of the emergence of mind from matter. He handled his material well, spoke eloquently, and beamed in delight as he passionately guided us through his insights. I could barely restrain myself as he spoke, because it was so clear to me he was completely missing the point. Whatever he was talking about, it couldn't have been consciousness. As soon as he invited questions, I rose to my feet and proceeded to harangue him with a merciless critique. Since consciousness is nothing if not subjective, how on earth could your model account for the emergence of subjectivity from wholly objective matter? Your whole thesis is built on shifting sands, mere castles in the air, and doesn't even begin to tell us anything about consciousness. It is nothing more than tightly argued materialist supernaturalism. That is, utter hogwash. Well, these were not my exact words, but they capture the essence of the tone and content of my response to his lecture. The young materialist sat off to the side, visibly shaken, as the next speaker took the podium. All the fire and enthusiasm had drained from his face. Just a few short minutes ago, this young man was vital and vibrant, excited by his ideas, putting forth something he passionately believed in. Now he looked shattered. "Oh my God, I did that?" I said to myself, burning with shame and guilt. If this was the price of truth, it was clear to me it wasn't worth it. There must be another way to do philosophy. And of course there is. Not all philosophers are so insensitive, though many are trained to be. For the rest of the day and throughout the night, the image of that shaken young materialist philosopher haunted me. I resolved to no longer search for truth at all costs. If the pursuit of truth leads to a bifurcation, separating it from wisdom and compassion, then something must be wrong. At best, such philosophizing could lead only to eviscerated abstractions and could tell us nothing of much value about the lived world, the world as we actually experience it. If philosophy of mind produces fine, detailed, meticulous arguments, but fails to embrace the fact that feeling is central to the very nature of consciousness, the what it feels like from within, then, I was beginning to realize, this discipline is moribund. The study of consciousness cannot rely exclusively on rational coherence, on relationships between concepts and ideas. It must involve the ineffable, pre-verbal, pre-rational process I can best describe right now as feeling our way into feeling, of experiencing experience. And the more I pay attention to this, the more I come to realize that first-person exploration of experience sooner or later comes with a message. And that message is, we are not alone. We are not isolated, solipsist bubbles of consciousness, experience, or subjectivity. Pick your favorite word. No, we exist in a world of relationships. We are, consciousness is, intersubjective. Any comprehensive investigation of consciousness must include the second-person perspective of engaged presence, of being in relationship. The next day I looked around for the young materialist, and when I found him, the light had come back into his eyes. I apologized, but he looked at me surprised. He hardly remembered the incident, and he expected no apology. That's the philosopher's training. Maybe my verbal attack did not, after all, faze him as I thought. Maybe I imagined or projected the whole thing. Well, whether real or imagined, the encounter served up an important lesson, nevertheless. And the lesson deepened that afternoon. Between lectures, I strolled around the poster sessions and was struck by one presentation in particular. It was called Pre-Conquest Consciousness by a Stanford University anthropologist, E. Richard Sorensen. His paper was also a chapter in a just-published book called Tribal Epistemologies. I didn't have time to read the entire paper, but what I saw caught my attention. Sorensen distinguished between two very different forms of consciousness: pre-conquest, characteristic of the minds of indigenous peoples, and post-conquest, typified by modern rationalism. Conquest, in this case, refers to what happened to indigenous consciousness and ways of life when the Spanish conquistadors invaded the New World. I picked up a copy of the book to read on the flight back to San Francisco. And Sorensen's thesis, based on many years of field study with numerous indigenous cultures, shocked me. I found out that pre-conquest consciousness is rooted in feeling, a form of liminal awareness hardly recognized in modern scholarship. Shaped by a lush sensuality where from infancy primal peoples grow up accustomed to a great deal of body-to-body contact, pre-conquest consciousness aims not for abstract truth, but for what feels good. Individuals in such societies are highly sensitive to changes in muscle tension in others, indicating shifts in mood. If others feel good, they feel good. If others feel bad, they feel bad. Sorensen called it socio-sensual awareness. In other words, the entire thrust and motivation of this form of consciousness is to optimize feelings of well-being in the community. What is real or right, and we might even call it true, is what feels good. In such cultures, the right or the true or the real is a question of value, not a correspondence between some pattern of abstract concepts and empirical fact. Significantly, post-conquest consciousness is radically different. Based on dialectical reasoning, it intrinsically involves domination or conquest. A thesis is confronted and conquered by its antithesis, which in turn is obliterated by a new synthesis. By its very nature, then, dialectic, rational, post-conquest consciousness is confrontational. This insight alone stopped me in my tracks, particularly following my experience with the young materialist philosopher. But what I learned next shook me to my core. Given the different dynamics and intrinsic motivations underlying both forms of consciousness, when post-conquest rationalism meets pre-conquest feeling, the result is outright suppression and conquest of feeling by reason, inevitably. In its search for truth, reason operates via conquistadorial dialectic. One idea or one person's truth is confronted and overcome by an opposite idea or someone else's truth. The clash or struggle between them produces the new synthesis, perceived as a creative advance in knowledge. By contrast, liminal or pre-conquest consciousness, in striving for what feels right for the collective, seeks to accommodate differences. When confronted by reason, it naturally wants to please the other, and so invariably yields. Reason strives to conquer, feeling strives to please. And the result? The obliteration or suppression of liminal consciousness, of feeling consciousness, by reason. Even more disturbing to me was the realization that none of this implies malicious intent on the part of reason. Simply encountering an epistemology of feeling, reason will automatically overshadow it, even if its intent is honorable. As I looked back on my own career, I found plenty of confirming instances. In my work, I have had many occasions to engage people interested in consciousness from perspectives other than philosophy or science, such as mysticism, shamanism, or aesthetics, for example. More often than not, even if I was trying to be considerate of their different ways of knowing, these people frequently left the encounter feeling abused are squashed or diminished in some way by having to match accounts of their experiences against the rigorous logic of rational analysis. When a search for truth pits dialectic reason against dialogic experience, the feeling component of the other's knowledge can rarely withstand the encounter. Feeling feels invalidated, and wisdom is blocked by truth. Sorensen's thesis allowed me to understand this dynamic in a way I hadn't before. His paper didn't leave me with merely an intellectual appreciation of the pre-conquest, post-conquest dynamic. He backed his thesis with a truly moving and shocking first-hand account of the disintegration of an entire way of life of a New Guinea tribe when their remote island was discovered by Western tourists after World War II. Before the invasion, the Neolithic hunter-gatherer tribe lived with as Sorensen said, a heartfelt rapprochement based on integrated trust, a sensual, intuitive rapport between the people. Their communication was spontaneous, open, and honest. For them, truth talk was affect talk, because, as Sorensen said, it worked only when personal feelings were above board and accurately expressed, which required transparency and aspirations, interests, and desires. What mattered was the magnitude of collective joy produced. Sorensen's own words were, quote, "In the real life of these pre-conquest people, feeling and awareness are focused on at-the-moment point-blank sensory experience, as if the nub of life lay within that complex flux of collective sentient immediacy. Into that flux, individuals thrust their inner thoughts and aspirations for all to see, appreciate, and relate to. This unabashed open honesty is the foundation on which their highly honed integrative empathy and rapport become possible. When that openness gives way, empathy and rapport shrivel. When deceit becomes a common practice, they disintegrate." End quote. Within a week, a way of life and a form of consciousness that had lasted for hundreds, if not thousands, of years had collapsed irreversibly. Sorensen describes a grand cultural amnesia where whole populations forgot even recent past events and made, as he says, quote, "gross factual errors in reporting them. In some cases, they even forgot what type and style of garment they had worn a few years earlier, or in New Guinea, that they had been using stone axes and eating their dead close relatives just a few years back. The selfless unity that seemed so firm and self-repairing in their isolated enclaves vanished like a summer breeze as a truth-based type of consciousness gave way to one that lied to live." End quote. 30,000 feet up, Sorensen's account of the crisis point in this people's cultural collapse brought tears to my eyes. He said, quote, "In a single crucial week, a spirit that all the world would want, not just for themselves, but for all others, was lost. One that had taken millennia to create. It was suddenly gone. Epidemic sleeplessness, frenzied dance throughout the night, reddening burnt-out eyes, getting narrower and more vacant as the days and nights wore on, dysphasias of various sorts, sudden mini-epidemics of spontaneous estrangement, lacunae in perception, hyperkinesis, loss of sensuality, collapse of love, impotence, bewildered, frantic looks like those on buffalo in India just as they're clubbed to death. 14-year-olds and others collapsing on the beach." Such was the general scene that week, a week that no imagination could have forewarned, the week in which the subtle socio-sensual glue of the island's traditional way of life became unstuck. End quote. Well, I had gone to that Tucson conference to make a case for the second-person perspective in the study of consciousness. I had written a detailed paper and had prepared a talk calling for the inclusion of intersubjectivity for a relational-based approach to understanding the nature and dynamics of consciousness. Few participants, it seemed to me, grasped the significance of dialogic consciousness. I was moved to include the second-person perspective because for years I felt something important was being left out of the debate between first-person, subjective or experiential approaches and third-person, objective, abstract investigations of consciousness. Since most of our day-to-day experiences involve relationships of one sort or another, it seemed to me that overlooking this common aspect of consciousness remains a conspicuous gap in philosophy of mind and in consciousness studies in general. The paradox or irony of my situation did not escape me. I was there to champion the primacy of relationship in consciousness, implying a mutuality of shared feeling. Yet the contrast between my intellectual analysis of intersubjectivity and my lack of experienced relational consciousness was stark. Not only in my relationships with others, but within myself, I had been using reason to the virtual exclusion of any real depth of feeling. My own professional life was a microcosm of the encounter between post-conquest and pre-conquest consciousness, between the modern rational mind and the traditional intuitive mind. Yes, I was accumulating philosophical knowledge about consciousness, but I was losing touch with the living roots of wisdom. If Sorensen's analysis of the fateful clash between post-conquest and pre-conquest consciousness is correct, then the prospect for non-rational ways of knowing seems bleak indeed. But only if we accept the rather unlikely premise that rationality is the epistemological endgame. Clearly, we have abundant evidence from the perennial philosophy and from modern spiritual teachers and practitioners that mystical experience transcends reason. We can evolve beyond reason. And when we do so, we do not obliterate the benefits our culture has gained from reason over the past 4,000 or 5,000 years. Put another way, even though historically, as Sorensen's work documents, when primal feeling-based knowing, the shaman's gift, meets modern-day reason-based knowing, the philosopher's gift and the scientist's gift, the encounter invariably decimates the former. But this need not be the end of the story. Beyond reason, we all have the potential to develop transmodern spiritual or mystical intuition, the mystic's gift. And this way of knowing includes and integrates all the other epistemological gifts. Whereas reason dominates feeling, mystical knowing does not conquer reason. It envelops it, embraces it, transcends it. Thus, mystical or spiritual intuition is integrative. It includes, while transcending, both reason and somatic feeling. Nothing is ever quite so neat, however, that it fits comfortably into such models, which, after all, are mostly the product of rational thinking. For example, it is not accurate to say that in every case where post-conquest reason encounters pre-conquest liminal consciousness, the result is the automatic obliteration of the indigenous mind. This may well be true culturally. At least I'm not aware of any meeting between groups between bearing modern reason and groups using primal knowing where the modern mind was consumed by the indigenous mind. But it is not true personally at the level of individuals. We know from the literature, anthropological and psychological, and from copious anecdotal reports, that when a modern reason-dominated individual ingests powerful psychoactive plant-derived substances such as ayahuasca or synthetic compounds such as LSD, the overwhelming effect is that reason takes a back seat. it is swamped by non-rational feelings and other ways of knowing. And according to many of the participants in these experiments or rituals, the states and contents of such altered consciousness are highly meaningful, informative, and veridical. In these instances, primal shamanic knowing does overshadow rational knowing. Furthermore, reason doesn't have to decimate feeling. It does so only when unplugged from its roots in the deep wisdom of the body. Reason is optimally effective when it retains or regains contact with its preverbal somatic roots. Reason works very differently when we feel our thinking. Many scientists and philosophers point to language as the key that makes humans unique among the animals. They are talking, of course, about a specifically human form of language, rational language. Possessing reason and the ability to express it through words is considered to be the essence of what it is to be human. Reason is supposed to be our shared essence, our unique identity as a species. And it is true that much of human life is embedded in language, but words and ideas, the currency of human communication, are double-edged. They help us with instrumental knowing, but remove us from intuitive knowing. When we speak, we lose touch with the feelings of nature. Words enclose us in a kind of abstract bubble, a film of language separating us from the forces, flows, and patterns of the natural world around us. And it's not just spoken language. We are even more removed from nature and its sacred patterns when language is written down. The alphabet has erected a barrier between our embodied intuition, between the natural wisdom of our flesh, and the flowing web of feelings coursing through the world around us. In the modern world, we have developed an over-reliance on reason, and this has shifted modern cultures out of balance with the rest of nature. But we fail to see that such over-reliance on reason is itself not at all rational. It is a distortion of reason. And that's a major part of the problem. This, of course, is not a new insight. Some of our best philosophers have recognized this imbalance between what we might call clear reason and distorted reason, between embodied or grounded reason and abstract or disconnected reason. Right back at the dawn of Western philosophy, Socrates and Plato knew that reason was limited, and that before anyone could know what those limits were, they had to master reason to get there. Only then could they move to the next stage. In the 18th century, philosopher Immanuel Kant took on this challenge as his life's work, and he demonstrated the imbalance in his great volume, The Critique of Pure Reason. Whitehead, too, was a master of reason, perhaps the best, because he moved far enough along to know that clear reason is rooted in feeling. Clear, embodied reason knows that the limits of reason are not the limits of knowledge, and certainly not the limits of reality. And failing to recognize this is a major part of the problem. And not just my problem, but it's a dilemma for the modern world in general. My story, I came to see, is itself a microcosm of what is happening not only in modern philosophy, but throughout modernity. Here's the dilemma. On the one hand, we have lost touch with the deep foundation of reason in the feelings of the body and the network of feelings in nature. On the other hand, we have not made full use of the gift of reason we already have. And this second problem is rooted in the first, but both must be worked on together. Our problem, then, is not really too much reason, but not enough reason. Not enough of the right kind of reason, of clear reason, reason rooted in the feelings of the body and open to the transcendental shafts of wisdom. In honoring feeling and intuition as ways of knowing, we may be tempted to reject or ignore reason, but we would do so at our peril. We cannot think or talk or write coherently without reason. as so much of our culture's knowledge is communicated through thoughts and ideas, especially philosophy, we need to pay attention to the gift of reason. For a long time, psychology was a misnamed science because it no longer studied the psyche, the consciousness, or soul. Well, in a similar way, modern academic philosophy is no longer an accurate description of this discipline as it is actually practiced. Having disconnected from feeling, philosophy has lost touch with Sophia, with wisdom. These days, disciplined searching for wisdom is the province of spirituality. Where philosophy seeks propositional truth and science seeks empirical knowledge, only spirituality seeks enlightenment, the realization of wisdom, consciousness, knowing itself. In exploring consciousness, science and philosophy seek truth. Spirituality seeks wisdom. And by truth, I mean two things. I mean, one, propositional truth, where language is rigorously self-consistent and non-contradictory. And two, I mean correspondence truth, where propositional truth, expressed in ideas and words, is confirmed by empirical evidence. The philosophical and scientific search for truth sometimes, at all costs, most often implies a particular kind of truth, that is, rational, logical, intellectual truth. But, as we've seen, truth captured in coherent and mutually consistent concepts, expressed in the precision language of philosophy, does come at a cost. The kind of awareness needed to pursue logical and rational rigor is frequently incompatible with the kind of awareness essential to spiritual wisdom. And by wisdom, I mean an often ineffable knowing born of direct experience, a kind of intuitive pragmatism that works to the extent it takes account of the whole. It is inclusive and integrative, and invariably involves empathy and compassion. Important questions about the relationship between truth and wisdom then naturally arise from this. For example, is the incompatibility between truth and wisdom contingent, or is it necessary? And if rational truth and spiritual wisdom are mutually exclusive, so that both cannot be operating at the same time, are they, can they, also be complementary? Well, we have already seen that truth grounded in clear reason, that is, rational truth informed by the natural intelligence of the body and open to transrational shafts of wisdom, can indeed be compatible with spiritual knowledge. Disembodied, abstract, rational truth, however, is not only incompatible with spiritual wisdom, it is inimical to it. It blocks it, suppresses it, or at best, distorts it. But in no case can reason, either clear or distorted, fully comprehend or express the enlightened knowing that we call wisdom. The deepest core and highest reaches of spiritual wisdom forever remain beyond the reach of reason and language. Though limited, the complementarity between philosophy and spirituality may be summarized as follows. On the one hand, philosophic knowledge of consciousness requires insights that come with the compassion and serenity of spirituality in order to expand from mere truth to wisdom. While on the other hand, mystical experience, invariably ineffable, requires the assistance of conceptual and linguistic rigor, as well as poetry, to express, as best it can, the wisdom of spiritual insight. Unfortunately, this complementarity is hardly recognized in modern Western philosophy as it searches for truth about consciousness. So much of academic philosophy of mind is about finding flaws in the other guy's logic and taking no prisoners. It operates from the assumption that progress is built on discovering what is wrong and then putting it right. We might even call it a via negativa, except that would distort the meaning of that phrase in spiritual practice. But philosophy need not be built in conflict on clashing worldviews. As John Stuart Mill noted when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, philosophers tend to be right in what they affirm and tend to be wrong in what they deny. Perceptive and wise insights like this show that philosophy can live up to its name. Imagine practicing philosophy by looking for what is right about the other guy's position. That kind of attitudinal shift begins to pull philosophy and spirituality closer together. I conclude with my own variation on this side, on this insight, something I mentioned in a previous lecture, that every worldview expresses some deep truth and is in error only if it claims possession of the whole truth. That is, there is probably some deep kernel of uncommon truth in every worldview, whether scientific materialism, spiritual idealism, mind-body dualism, or panpsychism. And the task of honest philosophers is to uncover such truths. The task of great philosophers is to find how these uncommon truths cohere in a common reality. And so we conclude Session 8. In the next session, The Cosmic Eye, we will explore how this common reality of philosophy may be the same one cosmos or cosmic eye of spiritual enlightenment. We will look at different meanings of cosmic consciousness, such as all-pervasive universal awareness and highest state of consciousness. We will investigate the differences between transcendent and immanent cosmic consciousness, between an objective out-there Godhead kind of consciousness and an immanent in all parts of the universe kind of consciousness. We will compare the psycho-spiritual development of individual beings toward the highest state of consciousness and mystical experience and the cosmic evolutionary unfolding of cosmic consciousness from light to enlightenment. We will conclude Session 9 by looking at David Bohm's implicate order and revisit Arthur Young's reflexive arc model of the journey of involution and evolution.